Welcome to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. I'm Russ White. At 6 past 4 following news, MSU J School alumnus and Detroit Free Press automotive critic Mark Phelan talks about the state of the automotive industry on opening weekend for the North American International Auto Show.
Coming in as a record year, I think, surprised everybody, but it was a great year, and the industry is still feeling the glow as the auto show opens up. And it gives them the confidence to invest in new ideas, new technologies, to try new body styles for cars, to do more than just play it safe.
Later, too, a conversation on climate change and its impact on our national security. MSU Today begins at 4:06.
Of the Great Lakes, inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's always a great pleasure at this time of the year to welcome to the program Mark Phelan. Mark is the highly respected and very, very busy Detroit Free Press auto critic. And we're going to do our annual chat as the North American International Auto Show opens this weekend. First, Mark, Happy New Year to you, and welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Mark, I went back and looked at some notes from last year and listened to the interview, and you cited some auto analysts in predicting that 2015 would be an outstanding year. You even mentioned over $17 million in sales. You were pretty close to the mark.
Well, they were, for sure. I have to say, the final analysis, with it coming in as a record year, I think surprised everybody. But it was a great year, and the industry is still feeling the glow as the auto show opens up.
What does a record year like that mean, other than the obvious? I mean, the obvious is that a lot of cars have been sold and the industry is doing very well. But from a psychological standpoint, a marketing standpoint, what does something like that mean?
Well, it makes everybody, as you would expect, feel good, and it gives them the confidence to invest in new ideas, new technologies, to try new body styles for cars, to do more than just play it safe. Which was the way everybody felt immediately after the Great Recession.
Yeah, a long way we have come since the Great Recession and the bankruptcies and those sorts of things. But on an even brighter note, folks are saying that 2016 might be a comparable year. What are you hearing?
That's it, absolutely. I mean, there's all sorts of uncertainties in the world, you know, with China's economy slowing down a little bit. But the outlook here in the U.S. is pretty darn bright. And in fact, one thing that could be a benefit to us if, you know, the Chinese economy does continue to slow a little bit is that automakers are going to pay more, even more attention to the United States market, because all of the underlying factors here look pretty strong. So this looks like it should be another real good year and another year of very low oil prices, which is good for sales, good for the general mood of the buying public.
Yeah, consumer confidence, a lot of reasons cited, low gas prices, interest rates are still relatively low and will probably go up. I mean, a lot of reasons, sort of a perfect good storm for automakers.
It really is. It is, and a lot of the programs that they dialed back to save money during the recession are now beginning to pay off, so we've got a good mood in the marketplace and lots of interesting new products, lots of interesting new technologies, and more technologies by far on the horizon. It's a very, very interesting time and a lot of really good vehicles to pay attention to.
Well, it absolutely is an interesting time. I grew up in the state of Michigan, worked one summer in a Ford plant and a couple of factories that did automotive supply products. But I don't think I can remember a time when there's so much change and so many dynamic new ideas in the industry. What's your take on that?
Oh, you're absolutely right. The industry is changing in almost more ways than people can comprehend. I mean, the idea that we will, within the next few years, have cars that drive themselves. the fact that safety is going to new heights, that automatic braking is going to become commonplace, all the different types of drivetrains and energy sources that are being used. It's a far more dynamic and, I think, more interesting industry probably than ever before.
Mark, as I'm reading some of the things as well, including your fine work, a bit of a paradox. Pickup trucks, SUVs, some of the larger luxury vehicles, some of those types of vehicles fueled the 17 million plus sales. But it seems like the industry is still very much committed to green technology. How do you explain that, what appears to be on the surface a paradox?
Well, there's no doubt that you're right about that. And the underlying key is that even those vehicles are far more fuel efficient than they were in the past. You know, some of the vehicles that are called SUVs are getting, 35 miles a gallon on the highway, frankly, because they are smaller and lighter than SUVs, of 10, 15 years ago. But also, even traditional pickups have become much more fuel efficient, much more efficient in all ways. I mean, people will always, there will always be families that need large vehicles. There will always be businesses that need vans and pickups that can haul large amounts of stuff. But the industry is finding ways to make those customer needs consistent with higher fuel efficiency as well. A little bit of when people say the industry remains very dependent or is even more dependent in some ways on trucks than it used to be, that's true at one level, but there are also a number of things that are considered trucks that didn't exist in the past. So it's an ongoing evolution.
My guest is Mark Phelan. He is the auto critic for the Detroit Free Press. Where are you with diesel technology right now?
Well, the technology is still terrific. The sales outlook may not be as bright because Volkswagen was the most eager seller of diesels, and they sold a lot of them. So the fact that they were not playing according to the rules is definitely hurting them, and it's reducing sales of diesel passenger cars overall. But the technology still is very promising. It gives you more power, higher fuel efficiency than a comparable gasoline engine, and particularly for trucks, it allows people to tow and haul more stuff than you generally can with a diesel. With a gasoline engine. So diesels, they face more challenges, but that's really in many ways a Volkswagen-specific problem, and the other companies that are selling diesels are in fairly good shape. The other German companies are eagerly pushing diesels across their model lines, and all of their diesels do comply with U.S. law. None of them are facing any sanctions. The American companies are pushing more and more diesels in their pickup truck fleets. GM added a smaller diesel in their midsize Colorado and Canyon pickups last year, and that's been selling like hotcakes. And this year they will be adding a diesel version of the new compact Chevy Cruze car. They sold a diesel of the last generation Cruze. It was quite successful. And GM actually thinks that they should be able to pick up some business because Volkswagen still does not have a diesel that is capable of meeting U.S. emissions. So there's an opportunity there. So diesel will continue to be a part of the market, although certainly the momentum has slowed because the biggest seller of them is out of the market for the moment.
Well, you mentioned GM, and let's stay with GM for a moment and talk a little bit about this new Chevy Bolt with a B, B-O-L-T, an electric car with a battery range of well beyond what my Chevy Volt has. Let's talk about the Bolt and the significance of this release.
That is potentially a hugely significant car. One of the justified complaints that a lot of outside observers have made about the auto industry is why aren't the traditional companies doing anything that matches the capability of what Tesla offers? And the Bolt looks like the answer to that question. After all of the federal tax incentives are applied, you'll be able to buy one for less than $30,000, and a range on a fully charged battery of about 200 miles, that's a better price and range than anything that Tesla offers at the moment. And it is really a testing to see how many people will, you know, take the plunge and buy an electric car, because at 200 miles a charge, there's really no practical reason for a lot of people not to look at it. So the Bolt is, you know, fascinating and really, really significant. It's going to be very interesting to see if it delivers everything that GM promises and how the public reacts.
Well, another dimension of the Chevy Bolt, and you're aware of this too, is its potential as a rideshare car. And this kind of segues into the new agreement between General Motors and Lyft. But looking at the Bolt from that perspective, that gives the car multidimensional capability, it seems.
It does. And fascinatingly, even though GM and Lyft just announced recently their cooperation, the car was developed specifically to work in ride-sharing systems, and frankly, we don't know exactly what that means yet, but it does mean the GM was looking at deals like this with Lyft, looking at how do they participate in a ride-sharing world. So it is conceptually, it's new and interesting, and it you know, shows this, you know, GM, which we had not been aware had any of that sort of future-oriented thinking going on, that there was planning, and now we get to see whether the planning pays off.
My guest is Mark Phelan. He's the auto critic for the Detroit Free Press. You know, Mark, as we're talking about ride-sharing and things of that nature, we're looking at the younger generation, we're looking at autonomous vehicles, but I don't know if you've had a chance to take a test ride in a Bolt. I'm sure that if you haven't, you will soon, but it seems like that car's been designed more for comfort and ride-sharing than it is perhaps for individual ownership.
There's a very strong possibility of that. It certainly looks like it will meet those needs very well. And yes, it's a very, in addition to the fact that it's an electric car that can go 200 miles, which I can't overstate the importance of that, it's a very roomy, comfortable little car, and it does look like something that people will be eager to at least experiment with ride-sharing, and ride-sharing is still in its infancy in the United States. It's basically, you have a vehicle when you need one. You call, you know, whoever, whatever service you work with, and you say, I need a car from noon until 5 o'clock on Tuesday, and one of these cars is available to you. You don't own it. You don't have to take care of it year-round and insure it. I've got some friends who have used that kind of service in Germany quite a bit, and they say that it is tremendously convenient and practical. So it's going to be very interesting to see not just how the Bolt fits into that model here, but how does that whole approach to vehicles work in the U.S. market?
Mark, you mentioned autonomous vehicles earlier in the interview. How far away are we?
Well, technically, we're there, but technically is only half the battle. The engineering, the equipment exists to make these cars feasible, but right now there's no regulatory and legal structure around them. So until we have rules that say this is how they must behave, they all have to meet the same standards, it's going to be a very limited market. But what we are seeing is the individual systems that, when they're all tied together, lead to full autonomy. We're seeing all of those individual systems deployed more and more. And this year, a couple of cars that promise to be closer to autonomy than anything other than the experimental vehicles that you know, automakers and Google are testing. There, a couple of those will be on sale this year, vehicles that have a limited ability to drive themselves with nearly no driver intervention. The Cadillac CT6 and the Mercedes-Benz E-Class, both of which are at the auto show, and they're the next step. But I would think that within 10 years, we will have some vehicles that are capable of driving themselves completely on the road. The big question is, you know, what are the rules and regulations? And part of it just comes down to, like I said, a legal structure, because there will be mistakes. There will be accidents, even when every vehicle on the road is autonomous. It's inevitable that stuff will happen. And one of the questions that gives all of the companies involved nightmares is, when an accident does happen, who's responsible, who faces the legal liability for it? So all of that is areas that will be worked out well after the big technical questions, I think, have been answered.
What is the health of the North American International Auto Show from your perspective?
It's very strong, very strong. I mean, the new vehicles that are introduced here are going to be some of the best-selling vehicles around the world. We've got Lexus sort of announcing a new direction for its whole brand here at the auto show. Hyundai launching their big international luxury brand, Genesis, at the show. So the show is strong. It and CES, the Computer Electronics Show, are becoming very complementary. And in fact, you'll see a lot of stuff that was at CES will also be on the show floor in Detroit.
Well, for more information, the website is naias.com. For more information, ticket prices are the same as last year, one of the best deals you'll ever find. The show runs through Sunday, January 24th. My guest for our annual visit, Mark Phelan, the widely respected and very busy auto critic for the Detroit Free Press. Mark, so many things to talk about. Thanks so much for your time. It is always a pleasure talking to you.
Me too. Have a great day. Thank you, Kirk.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Michigan native and retired United States Navy Vice Admiral Lee Gunn is on the CNA Military Advisory Board. That's an elite group of retired 3- and 4-star flag and general officers from the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps that studies pressing issues of the day to assess their impact on America's national security. Gunn joins Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and me now for a conversation on climate change and its impact on our national security. Here's President Simon.
It's really a pleasure to welcome retired Navy Admiral Lee Gunn to our program. Admiral Gunn is part of a group called Military Advisory Board, and it's an elite group of retired 3- and 4-star flag generals and officers, the cream of the crop in terms of our Army, Navy, and Air Force and Marine Corps. But they think about sort of forward-looking issues, about pressing issues that affect national security. And people would not necessarily equate national security and climate change. That's one of the big focus of your group now and why you're in Michigan. So why don't you tell our audience a bit about the work of MAB and then how it connected to climate change.
Sure, I'd be pleased to do that. And thank you to President Simon and Russ for having me here and giving me the opportunity to speak to the Spartans and the wider audience, whoever we're reaching today. The Military Advisory Board is a group, as the president said, of now 35 retired admirals and generals, mostly 3- and 4-star, who have convened since 2006 to conduct 5 studies and write one paper that's somewhat less comprehensive than a study. The convening purpose at the CNA Corporation, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit research and analysis organization that serves primarily federal, state, and local governments. The purpose of CNA's convening the Military Advisory Board was to examine, for the first time, I believe, from a national security perspective, the national security consequences of climate change. The climate is changing around us. The question was, Does the military need to encompass this in a meaningful way in planning? In particular, is the military doing that planning that we thought was necessary as retired senior flag officers? And if not, what was it they should do in preparation? The American people, after all, expect their military to be prepared for whatever comes. And so was there adequate preparation? And if not, could we make recommendations to our successors in the Defense Department about accommodating proposed changes or anticipated changes that they would face? This is important because the young men and women who come and join the military, the youngsters, the moms and pops of America sent to the military, are going to have to operate in the future in a somewhat different environment. The stresses that are placed on people around the world by the changing climate will aggravate some of the instabilities that we see around the world, and humanitarian assistance and disaster relief will become increasingly important parts of the military portfolio, even though they all already represent very important functions that the military performs. So we made some recommendations in a study that produced a report in 2007. Then we worked on three reports on energy. We thought some of the most thorny problems that were facing the Defense Department was moving of vehicles, whether they're ships or aircraft or heavy tactical vehicles, with new forms of energy. And so that was the second study we did, was transportation energy. The third study had to do with energy dependence. At that time, it was just the dawn of the fracking revolution, and the question was, what shackles do we have to work under as long as we're tethered to the worldwide energy structure? And the U.S. has a history of protecting the patterns of commerce that allow petroleum, among other things, to translate freely around the world. And then the fourth study, the last one on energy, was American competitiveness. The question is, there's going to be a new energy age dawning. What role should the American economy play? Because economic strength is important to national security. And then we did an update in a fifth report of the original climate change report. We said, it's 7 years have passed. Things are happening more quickly than we thought. Has the Defense Department accommodated in those 7 years as much as we think it should? Are they planning far enough in the future? And then we recently produced a report on energy again, but this time focused on the fragile energy distribution network in the United States. So I'd be happy to talk about any of those. But
let me sort of I'm part of a group that you know with Deborah Wynn Smith nationally on Council for Competitiveness. And interestingly, from a business perspective, because the universities are sort of intellectual thought partners in that, the same issues have been discussed about the need for energy security as both a national security issue but as an economic security issue.
Sure.
And that really leads to sort of, that study is now probably 7-8 years old, about the same time as your group, on the need to really think about energy independence for the United States in a multiple-stage portfolio. But so we think about it from one perspective, business competitiveness, from another, national security, and the issues all converge. And so what would be the simple lessons that you would want to convey to people, from their lives?
Well, one of the reasons that I've had the opportunity to travel more than once, now three times, to Michigan to talk about the Military Advisory Board conclusions is that I was born here. Mm-hmm. And my early years were spent here, so I feel like I'm coming home. I still have family here.
Yeah.
And so it's a privilege to come and talk to Michigan about things, I think, that are important on a national stage. And I have this abiding belief that Michigan can play an extraordinary, perhaps unique role in leading the energy revolution in the United States. My friend Mike Mullen, when he was still on active duty, Admiral Mike Mullen, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, equated diplomatic strength, economic strength, with military strength in terms of national security preparedness. So we have concentrated in the Military Advisory Board on this economic aspect as a pretty sustained theme through all of our studies. And I believe Michigan plays an extraordinary role. And as a matter of fact, President Simon, I talk about Michigan State when I go around the country. And so my point in highlighting some of the advances that have been made here are to let the rest of the country understand the enormous power that I see in Michigan in moving into this next energy economy. I mean, you have this terrific system of great American universities in Michigan. You have a tremendous number of very creative and energetic engineers in Michigan. Michigan added 44,000 manufacturing jobs in 2014. Mm-hmm. And there is this huge manufacturing capacity in Michigan. And Michigan ratepayers pay a higher amount of for their per kilowatt hour for their electricity than the national average. It seems to me there are all sorts of reasons, things that should urge Michigan to play a pivotal, if not a unique role, in leadership in the United States in developing the new energy economy. And so I think the economic recovery, which is underway in the United States, could be accelerated. And Michigan will play a leadership role, I believe, that's very important to the entire U.S. We're going to have a new energy economy. We can argue about when we'll wake up one morning and say, wow, it's here. But the fact is there'll be leaders and followers in this energy economy. Americans are not accustomed or comfortable with being followers. And so we want to lead this revolution, and I think Michigan is the place to do it. And I think the kind of considerations that you're having in your conference are just right in focusing our energy on that.
Well, we worked, I think, for our own, so we're sort of a microcosm of a small town with our own energy production as well as distribution issues. And we have invested probably a bit more in making sure that the infrastructure, the distribution system, is robust than most municipalities, because that's really one of the weaknesses for us in terms of making sure that research is uninterrupted, because that's the costs are both real and they're intangible in terms of if you have to start a discovery over that may be the next greatest cure, that's an intangible cost. There are tangible costs as well. So we spent probably a little bit more than most of Michigan as a utility on that kind of infrastructure. And we've also been, as you know, playing around with how to sort of balance our energy sustainability with great cost numbers. And we can't afford to have the cost rise in order to achieve sustainability. And I think we're like every community in that regard. So hopefully Michigan can get on the forefront as well as we look at other issues.
I think you're exactly right. And as a matter of fact, I specifically cite the Michigan State University initiatives that you and I talked about on a previous visit when I go around the country. My process is very directly trying to shame the rest of the nation into taking some of the steps that I see taking place here in Michigan. I'm very encouraged by the considerations that the legislature faces right now in putting forth an energy plan. I read Governor Snyder's message to Michiganders from March, cover to cover. Very impressed that lays out the kind of a plan that every state government should furnish to its people, to its industry, to its academics in pursuing this new energy economy. And we need an electrical distribution grid that is capable of accepting new forms of energy, is flexible and agile mm-hmm. enough to accommodate that, because that's the opening gambit in moving into this new energy economy in a very adventuresome way. I'm excited about what the university is doing, and
we're going to give it a try. I want to shift to a little bit away from energy, because I also know that as you all have looked at the world and you see, as many futurists do, food and the climate change effects on food as being one of the more significant issues, which I think relates a bit to your comment earlier about the military doing more humanitarian work in the future, to stop war as
yes.
opposed to be a part of war. Could you elaborate a bit on that for our listeners?
Yes. Individually, the members of the Military Advisory Board are interested. We haven't yet undertaken a systematic study of food and water security, but we recognize that both of those issues are going to be immediately important in the choices that large numbers of people make around the world as they face a changing climate. I mean, the climate has changed before, but we've enjoyed roughly 12,000 years of relative climate stability, and we've grown our civilizations in that time. There were just several millions of us scattered around the globe 12,000 years ago. There are over 7 billion on the planet now. This is the first time the climate has changed under these circumstances, with the demand to support 7 billion people moving to 9 billion in population. Water security and food security, I think, are going to be paramount issues that the U.S. helps the community of nations, has to help the community of nations deal with. I know that the university is very much involved in this, in research and in good works. The CNA Corporation has an energy, water, and climate group that is studying these things from a national security perspective.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR, and you're in the middle of a conversation between Lee Gunn, MSU President Luana K. Simon, and me. Gunn is a retired U.S. Navy Vice Admiral and part of the CNA Military Advisory Board.
One of the many reasons that the military is involved already so frequently in humanitarian assistance and disaster relief is because of water issues. Way too little or way too much, depending on where you are in the world. Increasingly, it's on the way too little mm-hmm. side. And 1 billion people on our planet, at least, don't have access to clean water every day. So it's not a need that is going to emerge in the future. It's going to worsen in the future, but it's already there. And in spots, the military has, U.S. military has been able to help. Every Marine and Army unit has reverse osmosis water purification units. And when Bangladesh in the early 90s was just devastated by a typhoon and tens of millions of people were displaced, the humanitarian assistance and disaster relief provided by the Navy and the Marine Corps with the Army and Air Force support was extraordinarily important in the recovery of that nation. But prominent in the stresses that the population was facing were water and food shortages. And so the U.S. as a government, the non-governmental institutions in the United States, I think increasingly are going to be called on to deal with water and food insecurity worldwide.
One of the things that I think the news tends to minimize those roles. They become a disaster and then it comes off the tweet or the front page and not the sustaining work that the United States, the military in particular, does around the world in these situations. And part of it is a little bit of a struggle to get that front and center in the minds of people to really understand the gravity of the problem.
Right. We recently had a change of command in the Navy, and we have a new chief of naval operations who absolutely will sustain, I think, the heavy strain that the previous chief of naval operations defined for the service. But the first principle for naval operations, Navy and Marine Corps, is operate forward. And the reason is because presence is everything. Things in the modern world happen really quickly. And if you're going to be effective, if you're going to make a difference, you need to be there to render aid immediately. And that applies to a variety of emergencies. in Indonesia, the results of a tsunami, the terrific tsunami a dozen years ago, was responded to by the 7th Fleet and the 7th Fleet Marines first, and then the Army and the Air Force followed up. And as a matter of foreign policy for the United States, the positive effect on the views of the people of Indonesia about America was profound. Prior to the tsunami, Indonesians, about 20% of Indonesians had a favorable view of the United States. After the relief effort was over and the military on behalf of the American people had made its contribution, more than 80% had positive views of the United States. The nuclear disaster in Japan, the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant meltdown, among the first forces on the scene were the U.S. 7th Fleet and U.S. Marines from Camp Fuji. And that there are examples around the world. One of the recommendations made by the first convening of the Military Advisory Board to the Defense Department was that we acknowledge explicitly in the mission set for the military humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. Up to that time, it had been, if you're ready for the Third World War, you have all this stuff and all these people, and you can do these other things too. But we are now so frequently involved in humanitarian assistance and disaster relief efforts. We recommended they be trained for, planned for, provided for, and purchases. Now that's part of the entire military mission set.
I'm on record making a couple of statements that were at the time controversial because of people tend to see the military in a particular context. And if you think about university students today, they've been a part of a generation where we have been in a skirmish, if not some definition of a war, for much of their lifetime.
Right.
And so that's the view, that's the predominant view of the military. And I made a statement that that one of the best investments is always an and investment instead of an or investment. And when you invest in the military, you know, there are people who do the rhetoric of it because we're going to go out and we're going to prepare for the war. We're going to go now from the perspective of current day people. It's another Scud missile. It's another thing, a drone we're going to drop on somebody. But really, it is the positive impact of that soft diplomacy, that humanitarian aid, that actually, I think, has proven to be more effective over time, as you've cited the numbers in Indonesia, than necessarily the separate efforts we've done in soft diplomacy, in my view. So there's an and there that that serves both purposes that are often one defined for the left and one defined for the right, but the inability for our country to push them together as a joint, something that unites us instead of something that divides us about tactics.
Well, I think you're exactly right on, and that won't be a surprise. But the American Diplomatic Corps, which is small and highly leveraged, there are about 4,500 career diplomats in the U.S. Foreign Service, and the United States military forces are very closely aligned. And we're not aligned because we're concerned with planning for the next conflict. We are aligned more often because the needs of the nation in which these members of the diplomatic corps represent the United States often can be satisfied in part or in whole by relations with the U.S. military. You're exactly right. I think people tend to look at the U.S. military, Americans tend to look at their military too often as being an organization that is only designed for and only plans for killing people and breaking things. We would actually far prefer to do things that foster the conditions under which people can thrive and succeed in their own countries. We can often do that by just being there, by helping with the stability picture. We can often do there by do that by lending a small piece of assistance. In West Africa, we partner with the seagoing services, who are often the Coast Guard and the rescue services for West Africa, rather than partnering with the militaries of these nations, because what the rescue services and the Coast Guards do is far more important to the indigenous people in West Africa. And I got to tell you, sailors and soldiers and airmen and Marines, they all understand, Coast Guardsmen, all understand the need to prepare for war. And that is what we do because Americans expect us to do. And when the war comes, they want us to be ready. But I've never seen sailors, soldiers, airmen more gratified than when they're able to help somebody. And every time a U.S. ship, every time an Army unit deploys to some location, in their off hours, the soldiers and the sailors, the airmen and Marines, are invariably doing some civic project, painting a school or tutoring kids or repairing a church or building roads. And you're exactly right, President Simon. That's where the real money is made for the United States in most cases.
I want to cycle back to sort of the energy-food connection. And I think you made a comment about the number of people on the planet. And I think we have had a period of people will say who are opposed to sort of thinking about climate change. Well, there's always been these variations. You've heard it all in your comments.
Of course.
There's all this variation. And so one of my quips is, yeah, but the dinosaurs didn't make it the last time. And so and there were fewer of them than we're worried about now. But we have crowded onto the planet more and more people. And we've also made the energy demands, the water demands, the food demands much greater. The expectations for what the amount of food that people should have are very different than they might have been in the Iron Age or the Stone Age. And so that those things are all coming together, that even if this is a blip of something that might in 1,000 years or 10,000 years solve itself in the natural way the Earth and its environment function, all these people in between make it a problem that has to be solved.
I couldn't agree more. And with this 12,000-year, roughly, mm-hmm. period of relative climate stability, predictability, we've always assumed that tomorrow or next year is going to look like today does. And during that period, we populated the planet. During that period, we built a whole lot of infrastructure we care about, which is within reach of the sea if the sea level continues to rise. We've built structures and societies and cultures and farming communities in ways that depend on tomorrow being the same as today. And we believe, I certainly believe personally, it won't be. And so we need to prepare for that. And because Americans are the big-hearted, industrious, outreaching people that they are, we are, Americans, I think, are going to feel inevitably an obligation to be of even more assistance to people who need even more assistance in the future. And so we need to pay attention to water quickly.
One only has to be in California now to understand that.
One has to be. And as a former Californian as well as a Michigander, I understand that very well. But we will address the problem because we have the resources to do that. In North America, we'll address the California, Arizona, Nevada problem. But people elsewhere in the world need profound help in providing water and providing clean water and improving sanitation, and all of this in the face of the potential for increased disease spread, one of the side effects of a warming planet, a rising sea level, changes in the flows in rivers because of melting glaciers. And so we can't turn away from this. I have kids and grandkids, and I do not want to be part of a generation that's made all the choices that determines that the world, those people, those precious young people, and your university students are going to live in and build families in the future. I want to leave a better world, not one that is more polluted, more difficult, hotter to live in.
If you scan the international news, it seems that wars are being fought around religious tenets right now. But the futurists believe that in some parts of the world now that get less attention in our press, they're being fought over access to food and water.
I agree. There are also some extraordinarily important charitable work being done by American organizations below the radar.
Yeah.
There's an outfit called Charity Water that is working in Africa. And I don't want to digress too much, but one of the things they do is build wells in villages. Mm-hmm. Villages where until the well is drilled and the water, fresh water is available, the young women in the society were consigned not to going to school, but to walking vast distances to get water every day to bring back for the family. When the well is drilled, the women go to school. And when the women go to school, the birth rate goes down and the economic activity goes way up. Mm-hmm. And so it is sometimes the sensitivity that we should show to the small changes that will reap big rewards. And water and food worldwide, I believe, are areas in which these kinds of initiatives can bear real fruit.
Well, we've sort of had a far-ranging discussion. Russ, do you want to jump in at all? You've had an opportunity to...
There was no need for me to butt in.
You just beat us back into shape,
To be able to interview Admiral Gunn on other occasions.
It's such a long way problem in a lot of people's minds where you're correctly saying this is happening today. How do we get people to get more involved and more realizing that we've got to make change and being the change themselves?
Sure. Well, it's a great question. And, of course, one of the really gratifying parts of being able to participate in the Military Advisory Board is this outreach activity that we do. We have been to 42 of the 50 states as a result of opportunities to go and talk to people who are interested in hearing a military voice talk about these critical climate, energy, scarcity sort of problems from a national security perspective. So just like my sailors and I in the Navy were always most gratified by the ability to contribute to infrastructure improvement wherever we were visiting around the world, we get to continue to serve in this way as volunteers who come together and study these things from a nonpartisan point of view and say our only interest is America's national security. As part of that, we care an awful lot about what the young women and men who are going to join the military will be called on to do in the future. How that'll be planned for, how they'll be prepared for it, how they'll be equipped to deal with this, and what the demands will be on them as representatives of the United States in the future. The moms and pops of America who send those young men and women to America's armed forces need to worry about that too. And they need to recognize, I think, that our concerns with developments abroad, the kinds of considerations we try to take into account for America's military of the future, should be their concerns here at home. America's military can only operate from a strong U.S. base. Our great ace in the hole is the American people. And the American people have to take this issue on and confront it. And so I've been very gratified by the ability to carry the message over the last several years throughout the country. It also gives us a reality check I mean, most of us live in and around Washington, D.C., and there's a certain insulation that comes apparently with that. But we break through that. We come out and talk to real people who actually have to pay rates for electricity, who actually have to farm crops, who actually have to build things, and who start businesses that either succeed or don't and get the bruises on them. And that's pretty exciting for us.
Well, and you're a great benefit to us as well. So we appreciate you and all of your colleagues for taking on this assignment on behalf of not simply the American people, but the globe.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you home, Admiral Gunn.
Yeah. Thanks, Russ. Okay. It's great to be back. And President Simon?
That was Michigan native and retired United States Navy Vice Admiral Lee Gunn talking with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and me, Russ White. Learn more by Googling CNA Military Advisory Board. And to hear that conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com. This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
MSU AgBio Research is really centered around leading research and developing scientific discoveries in the areas of food, energy, and environment.
Doug Buehler leads MSU AgBio Research.
Our history bases us in Michigan, but we've really expanded that mission to the nation and to the world.
MSU AgBio Research has more than 300 scientists representing seven MSU colleges.
We're very interested in continuing to build international linkages because of the importance of what we do and the global nature of agriculture and the global nature of a lot of the problems that we currently face.
MSU AgBio Research is leading research and scientific discoveries in the areas of food, energy, and the environment in Michigan, the nation, and around the world.
The core is that we do research on food, energy, and agriculture. The reality is that those three things are important to everybody every day of their life.
Visit agbioresearch.msu.edu.
Recycle Michigan, a place where there's no city limit, no boundaries, and the population, 9.9 million. So where is Recycle Michigan? It's located in your home, next door, down the road, in your very own community. In their continued effort to increase recycling awareness, the Michigan Recycling Coalition has launched the statewide Recycle Michigan campaign, serving as a resource to both businesses and residents. The Michigan Recycling Coalition provides simple steps to reduce waste, create awareness of the benefits of recycling, and to discover options for recycling through your local communities. By recycling, you, your family, your neighbors, and your community can help protect the things we love most about our state. Recycling junk mail, water bottles, and other containers will help keep our Great Lakes State clean, but it also promotes job growth in Michigan. Discover how you can become a citizen of Recycle Michigan by exploring MichiganRecycles.org.
For listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.